Welcome to Passing the Plate, the podcast that's all about food, traditions, and the wonderful connections they create. I'm Lisa Lisson, the genealogist and family history expert behind Are You My Cousin?
And I'm Ashley Covelli, the food writer and recipe developer behind Big Flavors from a Tiny Kitchen. We'll be your guides on this flavor-packed adventure. We're not just talking about recipes. We're diving into family history, exploring new cultures, and preserving favorite recipes for future generations. In short, we're celebrating the stories and tastes that come with every bite.
So grab a seat at the table and let's embark on a journey of flavor, tradition, and connection. This is Passing the Plate, where every episode is a feast for the senses and a celebration of the ties that nourish our souls.
In this episode, we're going to be learning all about how to start exploring your family history and starting your family tree. Plus, it's a chance to grab Lisa's list of favorite genealogy resources.
When you start to search for your ancestors, Ashley, one of the most important things to do is to begin with really what is already known in the family. And of course, what some people might recognize is that what I'm really talking about here is oral history or family stories. Because, well, you know, we talk a lot about food. We talk a lot about gathering at the table. And this is the best place. This is a place where families naturally share stories and information about the family. It's sitting down at the family dinner table, a holiday meal, a family reunion, or when they're attending a family event like the weddings that we talked about in a previous episode. This is a great place where families reminisce. The food gets people talking. And I actually will say a cup of coffee and a slice of your grandma's pound cake, really, that is probably the only tools you really need to get started in family history, because that's what gets the conversation flowing. When you can sit over a cup of coffee, when you can share a meal, share a snack or a delicious family recipe together, it taps into the sense of taste and smell and connection that allows the memories to really start to come up. Tapping into the sense of taste can really help bring up the memories when you're talking to family members and find out what they know.
So what about, I feel like we all have those relatives that their stories sound a little bit more made up. Maybe they're embellishing or elaborating. How do you know kind of what to lean into and what's real?
Okay, this is the fun part about family stories, oral history, and really kind of sitting back and listening to what's happening when you're all together. And the fact of the matter is, you don't always know what's fact or fiction. Most oral history is going to be, usually there's some basis for fact. It's not going to be fully accurate. In fact, I don't know that I've ever gathered oral history that was 100% accurate. Mm. But that's okay. The important thing is, oftentimes within those family stories, you're going to find clues that are hidden in there. So what you have to remember sometimes is that I remember interviewing my grandfather about the event about his mother, because his mother died when he was 12 years old. And so I was trying to gather the stories about her and gather the stories, you know, what do you remember? What was she like? What was her personality like? Well, he was only 12 years old when she passed away. Mm. So he had a 12-year-old's memories that brought forward. Well, I was able to interview his cousin, who was actually at the time she passed away, he was 15 or 16 years old. And he was able to tell me things about the fact that she, what a caregiver she was, and what a wonderful cook she was, and the dishes that she made, and she was always the first to show up with the homemade stew when somebody was ill. He had a whole different set of memories than the 5-year-old little sister, who had very spotty memories. So you have to remember sometimes and think about who's telling the story, and how could their ages have colored the story that's coming forward.
That's really interesting, because I know there are people in my family that I have different memories of than my brother does, but it's because he was so much younger when they passed away. And that makes a lot of sense when you're talking about that. But so what types of questions should you be asking family members when you're sitting down to kind of collect these stories?
So when it's time to sit down and really find out exactly what was happening in that family history, find the stories. A lot of times the stories are the ones that I've kind of gathered over time. But when you are really setting out to focus on building out your ancestry, your family tree per se, or just, you know, filling out the stories a little bit more, one of the things that I always try now to ask is to make sure that we're asking for things like, somebody's full name. You know, what was your grandmother's full name? First, middle, and last name. You know, did they go by a nickname? This is important. You know, what kind of nickname did they go by? So I had a story where I was actually interviewing some older cousins. This was a rare opportunity. I was so thrilled. And I kept talking about my Aunt Elton. We talked and they would tell me stories and the family. And finally, one of them looked at me and said, just who was Aunt Elton? Who was Elton? So I said, well, that was, you know, Anita's sister. And they went, oh, we only ever knew her as sister. That was the nickname. It was a very common name. She was the oldest daughter. She went by the nickname of sister. And that's how she was known for an entire side of the family. And didn't have any. So it's important to know who the nicknames are in the family and who they correspond with. But if you can find full names, if you can find birth, marriage, and death dates, those are kind of the three things that we as genealogy researchers are often looking for. And it doesn't have to be oftentimes the full date. It could be, well, she was born 5 years after me. I don't remember the month, but I think it was 1925, something like that, 1960. So sometimes you only can get an approximation of date, but that's still, with a name and an approximate date, you can go a long ways in the records. And then go ahead. Sorry.
I was going to say, that's interesting that you mentioned about like asking specifically for their full name, because I know my husband always talked about somebody in his family that he always thought her name was Anne Tethel, but it was how they were saying Aunt Ethel. They were saying it Aunt Ethel. So he just thought that that was her name. So it's kind of interesting. Like, if you would have written that down, he would have had a really hard time finding that person.
I love that. That's a great example. One of the reasons I ask for full names at this point is because there are some families have very common names that will go through the generations. Mm. And they might only change the middle name out. Right. And so I'm oftentimes wanting that full name so that if you're working with common names, I can better differentiate if I've got one person or if I'm looking at two people of the same name. And so, because that can get a little tricky once you get too far into the family tree, because just try it, guys. The genealogy bug will bite you and you will be off and running, spending all your evenings tracing your family tree. But it does help to know those things ahead of time. And again, sometimes the information is only known in the family and you want to capture that while you still can.
Do you know if it's less common now for people to be naming somebody after their mother or father, like junior or the third, you know? Because I feel like that was real common for a while. But I've feel like at least here in the States, we're kind of seeing that a little less, but I'm not sure.
You know, I've never really actually looked at it, but it certainly makes sense. And I actually probably think you're correct on that. There are traditional naming patterns that we see within families as we go through history. There's oftentimes here in the States, particularly if you're researching, say, colonial ancestors who have roots back in the UK, you will see that traditional naming pattern that they had. But there's also traditional naming patterns within different faiths. We'll have different naming patterns, different countries, different regions. So we can see that sometimes. It is very helpful if you really get into your genealogy research and you're really getting, further back in time to understand what those naming patterns were. Families didn't have to stick to them, but it's helpful to have kind of a general understanding so that it can give you clues to advancing your genealogy. But that's a little bit more advanced when it comes to research than what we're talking about today. The one thing, though, that I think that's really important, particularly here in the U.S., if you're doing research, would be to ask if there's a family Bible. And who has that family Bible? We don't see this as often with generations, the more current generations, but we do see family Bibles were kept as we go back in history, and they are fantastic references. It's kind of like the one thing we all want to get hold of if we possibly can. And so I always ask and to see who might have one, because you never know what might be tucked away in a back closet somewhere.
So what kind of thing would you things would you find in there that would help you with this type of research? Because I remember my grandparents had like this big, it was like a big oversized kind of family Bible with like, you know, gold edges on the pages. But I don't remember if they like wrote in it or anything. Are you looking for like handwritten notes?
You're looking for the documentation where they would go in and write down, say, when a child was born, they'll put the name, the full name down and put the birth date. They'll put in when couples got married, they'll document who got married and the date. They'll, which is when you are perhaps researching where records are scarce, to have a family Bible.
Mm.
That's a firsthand account because typically, you know, they're writing it down when it happened. And so those are tend to be more accurate. And certainly when someone passed away, that they'll write that in there as well. So those are very valuable for researchers, particularly when you start getting earlier in time when maybe, you know, birth certificates were not required to be registered at the state level. So it's a different type of source. I like the family Bibles because sometimes you'll see them, you find little stories in them. They might actually, you know, if a couple's marriage didn't stay together, they might mark something out and things like that, that are kind of an interesting, unique perspective. But they're valuable from a researcher standpoint. People want them because it also might list every child that was born.
Whenever I think of things stored in the family Bible, I cannot help but think of the story. And I can't remember if it's my mom who told me, but somebody that they knew, the parents would press, you know how you can like press things in heavy books, their kids' umbilical cords in the family Bible. And I'm like, I don't know what I think. I mean, that seems a little much.
It seems a little much. I personally, no, I've never seen that, never thought about that, quite frankly. But, I mean, there are some cultures that do save the umbilical cords from children. I've not heard of it in the family Bible before. But I do know that for some cultures that to save that is important. Mm. I don't know much beyond that. From a researcher, you know, if you are just starting out and trying to learn a little bit about your family history or just starting out to fill out your family tree, the family Bible's a fantastic place because you can typically find multiple generations that are documented. Mm-hmm. And it's by people who typically, you know, they knew the family, they're part of the family. And so it tends to be fairly a little more accurate. So that
wasn't just some government office. For it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But you're right. Some of the ones that are a little more modern or more modern times, you might find really cool things stuck. People stick important things that are important to them, little mementos. I have found things in, say, like little funeral cards that might have been stuck in a Bible. I've seen newspaper clippings of a family event that happened stuck in a Bible. So sometimes you find that kind of thing in a family Bible. So I always look at what was written, but then I thumb through to see what might fall out of its pages.
Right.
So you might want to be careful.
If you come across umbilical cords.
Are you worried your family recipes will be lost to time? Imagine generations gathering around your family, sharing stories, and enjoying dishes passed down for years. With the Passing the Plate video webinar and ebook bundle, you can make that happen. You'll learn how to capture those cherished recipes before they're lost from memory, uncover the secrets and heartwarming stories behind each dish, and connect you to your family's history in a powerful and delicious way. To learn more, head to passingtheplate.org/resources. But anyway, but once you have found, so if you are, again, if you're starting out on those, your family tree, you know, if you can get the names and any nicknames, that birth, marriage, death dates to help you find clues, you're in a good start. And then once you've done that, what a lot of people do, and what I certainly have done, is I head to the U.S. Census records. Now, census records are not unique to the U.S. That's primarily the ones I've worked with because I'm a U.S. researcher, but other countries have them as well. But the census record, they come in and they take, you know, an accounting of everybody in the household. And it's a great way of documenting who was where and in what household, and you can find family units that way. And one of the reasons that we as researchers, as genealogy researchers, go into those so early is because they're easy to get, okay? You can actually find them for free over on FamilySearch. They're also in the paid genealogy databases that are out there as well, Ancestry, MyHeritage, Find My Past, but they are free at FamilySearch. And you can literally track your family back through the decades because the U.S. Census was started in 1790. It was taken every 10 years. and coming forward. I think the most recent one here in the U.S. was in 2020. Now the public is only able to view the ones from 1790 up through 1950. So privacy laws, they won't release it. They only release census records to be viewed to the public 72 years after the event. So
How did they come up with that number?
I don't know why, but I do know that when they released the 1940 census, that the genealogy community pretty much crashed the website trying to get to it.
They broke the internet.
We broke it. But so when they released the 1950, they didn't have an issue with that. That was all taken care of.
I wonder, going back, how accurate some of the census, not necessarily in the U.S., but in other countries might be. Because I remember some story with my father-in-law. He grew up in Calabria in Italy. And I remember something about the day he was born, you're supposed to go and report it to whoever in the town that kept the records. I don't know if they called it a census, but the mom said it was a different day than he was actually born so that they would get more, I don't know if it was some sort of support from the government. So the birth date on his birth certificate, I think, was not his actual birthday. It was off by a couple, which I thought was kind of interesting.
That is interesting. And that brings up a good point. A lot of the records that we use, are not always 100% accurate. Census records are certainly not 100% accurate because the census taker in the early years literally went door to door and copied things down. And honestly, you don't really know who was giving the information all the time. It could be the next door neighbor saying, well, yeah, I think he's about 32 and she's probably about 30. So, sometimes the birth years and things like that might be off. Spelling will be typically not very consistent. and that's okay. You just have to be aware of that. I like that story. Again, I love the story that you just told about your grandfather and his birth year being adjusted. You have to think about the times that your ancestors were living in, the family was living in, and what did they need to do to make life a little easier sometimes. And so there are usually reasons for that kind of thing. I love that story though. But if you didn't have that story, you might not know his accurate birth year.
Right.
You talked about your father-in-law growing up in Calabria and that the family, did not have a lot, essentially, that they were fairly poor. And so I'm curious, you shared the story about they adjusted his age to get more support. But I'm also curious about maybe how did that play out with their life in general? Were they farmers or what type of occupations did they have? What types of foods did they eat? Because all of that gives us a picture of who your father-in-law was as he grew up and who his family was as well.
Yeah, so I've talked with my husband about this, and when my father-in-law was around, we talked about it. I mean, he says, they were very poor. They didn't have a bathroom in their house. They would heat up a brick to put in their bed to keep warm at night. I know that they had a pretty big garden outside and a couple animals. He talked about taking some of the wheat or whatever grains that they grew to somebody in town who would grind them. And I guess the way to get your grains to, bake bread or whatever you were going to do with your grains, the person that would grind them would either take then a portion of what you brought as payment, or you could, trade something, barter. I don't know if you had stuff from the garden to trade or something like that. So I know there was a lot of bartering going on. If one person had a lot of tomatoes and the other person had, something, chickens, and they wanted eggs, just trying to, really work with the community was something that they did a lot there. And their food was really humble, very, he would call it peasant food. So things and some of those things have been elevated now in more modern times in the U.S. where things that they considered kind of poor people food, people have now made a little fancier. So I know when he would talk about polenta, that was a pretty inexpensive thing to make from the grains. And he had described the family kind of preparing it and then pouring it out on the big table to cool. And then they would just kind of scoop it off of the table. I don't know if they would add toppings and stuff, but just, trying to feed a family on barely any income. His father was a miner. So he was out working in the coal mines all day. It was really hard work. And a lot of the recipes that I learned from him are, you know, things with really simple ingredients. So it's they kind of come together to be more than just the sum of their parts. And it's a lot of comfort food, you know.
I like that. And I like what you said about that, because it absolutely, from what, just having known you over the years and the types of foods and recipes that we've talked about, some of the recipes you've gotten from your father-in-law, definitely I see that story kind of playing out with, it's these very simple ingredients, which your father-in-law was a fabulous cook, and, and the recipes you've shared have been amazing, but they are the very basic types of foods. And I think that's, he obviously had a talent for that, but I think it also truly, even throughout his life, as he, you know, cooked with you and with your son, really did speak to his roots and speak to the family's history. And so I think that, and I think that's a beautiful thing. I think that's something that, it's a very innate connection that you can make. And it's not something that's easy to put into words, but there is that connection that through those simple foods that you are able to tap into that history.
Yeah. Well, and it's interesting too, because as a, I don't remember how old he was when he moved from Italy to Belgium for trade school. And so he's got a little bit of the like Belgian influence in his cooking too. So he would make like some really fun, like, you know, like cream puffs and like more pastry type things. And it just, it was interesting because those were both very big parts of his repertoire. And then, yeah, he would just make everything his own. So never wrote down a recipe, but we got some of them.
That's okay, because you've taught us how to fix that.
Yes, exactly.
In previous episodes. All right, guys. So if you guys are interested in learning to document your family tree, find your ancestors, I have a resource. It's called My Big Genie List. It's a comprehensive list of my favorite and most often used genealogy resources. And it includes websites, it includes tools, it includes the databases that I use. So whether you're really a beginner or you've had and you are an experienced genealogist, you'll find resources for researching all aspects of your family history in that thing.
And can I tell you, until I met you, I didn't realize that genealogists called themselves genies. And I just think it's hysterical. It's so good.
We do. Yes, we call ourselves genies every now and then. Some people just call us crazy, but that's another story.
To get your own copy of Lisa's Big Genie List, as well as her resource on genealogy for beginners, head to the show notes for this episode at passingtheplate.org/15.
Well, that's a wrap on this episode of Passing the Plate. We hope you enjoyed our journey into the world of food, traditions, and the amazing connections they create.
As always, it's been a pleasure sharing these delicious stories with you. Remember, food is more than just sustenance. It's a way to connect the dots between our past, present, and future.
And until next time, happy eating, happy connecting, and pass the plate. Head to passingtheplate.org/podcast for show notes.